We've heard that there might be a brand new terrorist around. We've heard the words this far extremist says. Click around your cable dial, you're bound to hear the sound. He's declared fatwa on the Venezuelan prez. And here's to you, Reverend Robertson. Jesus doesn't even watch your show. No, no, no. God's ticked at you, Reverend Robertson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. You'll go away. Hey, hey, hey. We'd like to know a little bit about you for our files. We'd like to put your TV show on mute. Your greatest proof against intelligent design. Please tell us once again now, who would Jesus shoot? What's that you say, Reverend Robertson? Jesus loves you if you're not a hoe. Ho, ho, mo. Thou shalt not kill, Reverend Robertson. But brain cells, you are murdering so slow. When people watch your TV show.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and the Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We continue with Dan McMillan explaining the Holocaust.
You know, there were a lot, and this is absolutely crucial, because in Germany and in Europe during the first four decades of the 20th century, there are all kinds of different antisemitisms, not just one antisemitism, but many different strands of antisemitism. Antisemitism as a religious prejudice, antisemitism as hostility to economic competitors, as a form of social snobbery. And all these different forms of hostility to the Jewish people were important and played a role in the Holocaust in one way or another. But this particular strand, the equation of Jews and Marxism, blaming them for the communist threat, which was something that in the 30s and 40s was very deeply feared. This is the strand of antisemitism that led explicitly and directly to the Holocaust. This is what Adolf Hitler and his accomplices were talking about. This is part of their justification for what they were doing. Altogether, this right-wing political strategy to contain socialism by using national unity and attacks on the Jewish people, this is almost certainly where Adolf Hitler got his ideas about the Jewish people and his ideas about many other things. Nazism, one can interpret as being essentially just a radicalized version of this notion we can unite all Germans together against our enemies. And in propagating this antisemitism as part of this defensive strategy, Germany's elite indoctrinated themselves. They believed their own rhetoric. And this goes a long way to explaining why so much of the educated elite of German society participated in the Holocaust, most of them, it seems, quite willingly, and the rest certainly without complaint. And without their participation, particularly I'm thinking of in the military and in the higher civil service, the Holocaust, as we understand it, would simply not have been possible. So to take stock of the argument so far, the factors that I've tried to analyze for you here take us a long way to explaining the Holocaust, and that they help us understand where Hitler came from and how he got his ideas, why his ideas enjoyed substantial resonance among the educated elites that he needed to carry out his programs, and altogether how a man like Hitler could have come to power, and that's absolutely crucial to understanding the Holocaust, because if there's one point on which historians agree, it is one important point, without Hitler, the Holocaust would not have happened. He didn't do it all by himself, and he's not an alibi for the rest of the German people, but it is also clear that he was indispensable. So anything that the sequence of events that got him into power is a crucial part of any explanation. And yet, that said, what I've talked about so far, it doesn't add up to murder. I just don't see how it does. It's enough to explain discrimination, such as the Jews of Germany suffered in the 1930s. And therefore, I want to briefly sketch out for you three other factors that together performed a radicalizing function and helped to make it possible for us to understand the great leap from persecution to genocide. The first of these is the extraordinary popularity of Adolf Hitler. And indeed, popularity is too weak a term. It is probably more accurate to speak of deification. Millions of Germans worshipped Adolf Hitler. They believed that he was a genius of superhuman, or even in the minds of many Germans, supernatural capabilities. And in many Germans, this inspired, and particularly in the Nazi Party, a loyalty to Hitler so fanatical that they would gladly do anything that he asked of them. And in a much larger universe of Germans, and here I'm on the realm of an educated guess, because I'm talking about something that by its nature would not have left traces in the documentary record, and yet it seems a reasonable kind of safe assumption. I think it's reasonable to assume that among very many other Germans who may not have been committed Nazis, nonetheless, a belief in Adolf Hitler's magical abilities or magical qualities could have gone a long way to neutralizing whatever misgivings they might have had about his more radical policies, including his policies toward the Jewish people. People could have, in effect, have said to themselves, and there's a little bit of documentary evidence for this, that I'm not sure how I feel about this, but the Führer sees things and understands things that us mere mortals do not, and therefore perhaps if he wants it done, it should be done. In any case, perhaps the more interesting question is, where did this popularity come from? Given all we know about Adolf Hitler, given not only his moral depravity, but the fact that except for his gift for public speaking, he was a thoroughgoing mediocrity and someone whose personal qualities were repulsive. And yet, this man is worshipped by an entire nation, or seemingly so. On closer inspection, it's actually not so difficult to understand. Hitler was worshipped because he was fabulously successful. You have to remember the condition of Germany when he took power in January of 1933. The German people were on the ropes. Unemployment stood at 30%. The government was paralyzed. And over and above that, it was entirely unclear what form of government, if any, could function in Germany and could allow Germans to come together and govern themselves as a society, because the old imperial system had collapsed at the end of World War I. The democratic alternative that had been tried for 15 years up to that point also seemed to have completely failed. The way forward was entirely unclear and the situation was dire, and yet within only a few short years, Hitler seemed to have solved all their problems and appeared as the savior of the country. I'll give just two examples. The first is, he comes to power in 33, unemployment is 30%. Only 4 years later, Germany has returned to full employment. In our country, unemployment remained in double digits till war production in World War II kicked us out of the Great Depression. Germany was the only major industrial economy to climb out of the Great Depression in the 1930s. That alone won Hitler a great deal of admiration. But a second example, in the spring of 1940, German forces invade Western Europe. They conquer France. They drive the British armies off the continent of Europe in only 6 weeks of fighting and at the cost of only 30,000 German soldiers killed. Compare this to their experience in the First World War, where the Germans fought for 4 years, they lost 2 million men, and they lost the war. You know, measured against that yardstick, I think that Hitler would have appeared as a miracle worker, not only to Germans, but to the people of any country who had experienced their experiences. So, the worship of Hitler is one radicalizing factor. The second is that the pointless slaughter of 10 million young men, including 2 million German soldiers in the First World War, can be said to have devalued human life, to have lowered the bar for violence in Europe. All of the later violence in Europe in the 20th century, the crimes of Hitler, the crimes of Stalin, everyone else's crimes, is just not conceivable without the precedent that was set and the damage that was done to the value of human life by this slaughter. And for many men who lived through it, including combat veterans like Adolf Hitler, who served for 4 years on the Western Front, with World War I as their point of reference, murdering millions of civilians could seem like nothing more than one of those perhaps regrettable facts of political life. A third factor, finally, one that reinforced in its effect the dehumanizing consequences of the First World War, is that racism back then, unlike today, was not seen as the prejudice of the uneducated, of people we would call losers, but rather had complete respectability, was seen as science, and this made it possible to define the Jewish people as almost a separate species and thereby to rob them of their humanity, which made it a lot easier to murder them. And the Holocaust happened, you know, for about a half a dozen other reasons as well. The ones I've summarized for you here, I think, are, however, the most important and could stand as the core of the argument of my book, although there's a lot more that I have to say. One of the things that's so fascinating about the Holocaust is that the causation of it is so utterly complex.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, as well as at Facebook. Now back to Dan McMillan attempting to explain the Holocaust.
Now I want to return finally to the question I posed to you at the beginning of our conversation, which was, why does the Holocaust frighten us? What is different about it? Why is it so important to us? I want to tell you a story. It's an incident that took place in the Treblinka death camp in 1942 or 1943. We learned about it from the journalist Gita Sereni in a series of interviews she conducted in 1971 with a man named Franz Stangl. Stangl had been the commanding officer, the commandant, at two death camps in German-occupied Poland, first at Sobibor, then at Treblinka. And in this capacity, he had orchestrated, he had organized, he had presided over the murder by poison gas of hundreds of thousands of human beings. And these human beings were murdered for one reason and for one reason only. Okay, they were murdered because they were Jewish. And yet he insisted he was not and never had been an anti-Semite. Indeed, Stangl claimed to have had in his terms quite friendly relations with the Jewish prisoners in the camp. And when asked, was there any aspect of his so-called work at Treblinka and Sobibor that he had found pleasurable? He said with emphasis, "That's what I enjoy, human relations, that is, with prisoners." And to appreciate how grotesque this notion is, you have to remember that every single one of these prisoners was living under a sentence of death. Stengel allowed them to live only so long as they could serve their German masters as slave labor to help keep the camps running. And as soon as they had outlived their usefulness, their lives were over. And these prisoners understood this terrible reality every bit as well as Stengel did, and yet nonetheless, his contact with them is supposed to be friendly and for him enjoyable. His chief example of his enjoyable human relations with condemned men was with a man named Blau from Vienna. In Stengel's telling, one day Blau came to Stengel's office. He stood to attention. He formally requested permission to speak. He looked very worried. Blau's 80-year-old father had just arrived in a cattle car from Vienna, and he was going to perish in the gas chambers of Treblinka in a matter of hours. Stengel replied, "Really, Blau, it's quite impossible. You misunderstand a man of 80. By which he meant that, Stengel meant that since Blau's father was too old to be useful as slave labor, Stengel could find no excuse to postpone his death. The younger Blau indicated that he understood this, but he just did not want his father to meet his end in the gas chamber, and so with Stengel's permission, he took his father to the kitchen, served him a final meal, then escorted him to the so-called infirmary, which was a sort of medical structure disguised as a medical facility by a Red Cross on the wall. There at the door, the two men would have said their goodbyes. A prisoner from the camp would have escorted the elderly man down a long corridor to the edge of an open pit. There, an SS guard, most likely a man named August Mitte, who was notorious for his sadism, ordered the old man to take off his clothes, stand on a plank at the edge of the pit, and then murdered him with a pistol shot to the back of the neck. Later that day, Blau returned, the younger Blau, returned to Stengel's office and thanked him. "Well, Blau, there's no need to thank me, but if you want to thank me, you may." In Stengel's eyes, he had done Blau the favor of arranging to have Blau's father murdered by gunshot instead of by poison gas. And this favor counted for Stengel among the human relations that he had enjoyed with prisoners during his time at Treblinka and at Sobibor. And I very much wish that I could say to you that Stengel was an aberration and that his attitude toward these prisoners was atypical. But I think instead one must have to see this as near as we can tell, an attitude that was emblematic of the way that many perpetrators of the Holocaust thought about and felt about their victims. They subscribed to a racist belief system which held that Jews were not fully human, and thus killing them was nothing to be upset about or anxious about or to feel any tension about. And they could and did live among these condemned victims in the camps, in the case of some prisoners, for a period of years and move among them every day and talk to them every day without any apparent sign of discomfort. Their attitude toward the people they were murdering is reminiscent of nothing quite so much as that of a farmer living among livestock that he is destined for slaughter. And this attitude, this way of seeing and thinking about and feeling, or rather not feeling, about the victims, in my view, goes to the heart of what makes the Holocaust so important. The Holocaust is so important, I contend, because it constitutes history's most uncompromising rejection of the idea that human life has any inherent value or meaning. And I think you can best appreciate the import of what has been a somewhat abstract statement that I just made by asking yourself, why not? Why not commit murder? How do you know, and the emphasis is on certainty, how do you know that murder is wrong? And to this question, we all have the same answers. We believe that human life is precious. We believe that every individual has rights. We believe that our existence here on this planet has a meaning and a purpose. These are good beliefs. They're healthy beliefs. They're your beliefs and mine also. But they're exactly that. They're beliefs. They're not facts that you can prove. The proposition that human life has intrinsic value or significance is not a demonstrable fact. It's a postulate. It's an unsupported assertion. And you can choose to accept it, or you can choose to reject it. And this choice to accept or reject, to embrace or to deny the value of human life is the most important choice that any of us can make in our entire lives, and hardly any of us is ever aware of having made it. We're not aware of it because it's been made for us by the people around us, by the families into which we are born, by the society in which we live. It is a choice that has been unstated, that has been assumed. It is a choice of which we have been happily innocent. And one way to characterize part of the horror of the Holocaust is to say that the Nazis made a theft of our moral innocence. They revealed to us the terrible truth that this is a choice, and that it is eminently possible to choose very differently from how we have chosen. They did this by themselves choosing to affirm that human life is utterly without significance or meaning or inherent value, and they made this affirmation explicitly in the most uncompromising terms and on an absolutely massive scale. I'll make this concrete with a few examples. In the Holocaust, the killers expressed their moral nihilism, their rejection of the value of human life, in words and in deeds that were unique or very close to unique to the Holocaust, that found only the most limited parallels in any other episode of genocide or atrocity. First, what is very striking about the Holocaust is the way that they deny their victims' humanity. In the language they use, calling them vermin and microbes and pests and subhumans and bacilli and bacteria and so on. And if you are familiar with the Rwandan or the Armenian genocides, you will have encountered some of this language like this, that is to say. But in those episodes, it is used in relative terms sparingly, and it is always used metaphorically. In the Holocaust, this language is taken quite literally, and it's used pervasively. Secondly, related to that first point, is the way that they denied their victims' humanity by reducing them to the status of material objects that they processed for value, almost as if they were animal carcasses, using Jewish prisoners as laboratory animals, harvesting the teeth to melt out the fillings, shearing off women's hair to make textiles. A second distinctive feature of the Holocaust is that in sharp contrast to, say, the Armenian, Rwandan, or Cambodian cases, the victims of the Holocaust were not murdered for any immediate practical purpose that one could remotely define as rational. It was rather that the very existence of the Jewish people was unacceptable to their killers. And for the first time and only time in history, we have come to murder millions of our fellow human beings for the purpose of taking their lives. Their deaths were an end in itself, which leads me to the third and last point I wanted to make in this connection, which is that the Jewish people are the only large ethnic minority who have ever been targeted for complete biological extinction. The Nazis hoped to murder not only the 11 million Jews who, by their calculations, lived on the European continent, but had they won the war in Europe and with the resources of the European continent at their disposal, been militarily capable of overwhelming the United States. We can't prove this because it didn't happen, and yet it's sort of in the logic of what they were doing in Europe and in so much of what they said. We tend to agree that the next step would have been to strike at every single remaining Jewish population around the globe, no matter how small. The perpetrators of the Holocaust saw the Jewish people the way public health officials used to see smallpox, as a virus that had to be eradicated completely so that it could never, ever, ever grow back anywhere on Earth. In sum, moving to conclusion, the Nazis have compelled us to confront the horrible question of whether our life has meaning, worth, significance, purpose, because they affirmed so dramatically with such determination on such a colossal scale that it does not. And this, I think, I contend, is what makes the Holocaust unique and what makes it important and what makes it so frightening, is that the Holocaust is the historical event that, far more than any other, confronts us with questions of existential significance. And as anyone who has pondered them can tell you, the existential questions are the scariest questions of all, and also perhaps the most difficult to answer. I'm going to have at the end of our conversation 2.5 minutes of concluding remarks. I now want to stop and take questions from you. If you have a question, please move to the microphone on that side of the room. And
good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Nancy Pelosi, and I'm going to be your next Speaker of the House. Thank you for that warm welcome. Now, as you know, I've pledged a whole new era of bipartisan cooperation, so I'd like to get to know the audience a little bit tonight. Do we have any Republicans here? Where are they? Applaud? Anybody? There they are in the back there. Now, to both of you, I would like to say thank you. Thank you for taking time off from watching Fox News so that you could be with us this evening. How about Democrats? Do we have any Democrats here tonight? All righty. Now, fellow Dems, let's be gracious. Let's try not to gloat. Oh, who am I kidding? Hit it, maestro! Things look swell. Merry gays, raise the terrorist minimum wage. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's run by Pelosi. You got it. Raise the bar. Hybrid cars. NBC will become NPR. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's run by Pelosi. I got 6 grandkids. Aren't we damn swell? Soon the White House is mine. I'll show them well. My running mate will be a stem cell. I'll be grand, feeling great. And I don't have to wait till 08. Since I start third in line, Cheney's heart ain't that fine. And then we impeach George Bush, I guarantee. All right, Oprah, but then me.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.